This examination project, I hope that you have seen the message that I posted today. This one, grading of the first examination project, with a message that every 4th year it is required that there is an external examiner involved in grading, and this is the 4th year now. And I am still waiting for the external examiner's report. I finished myself with reading and grading myself all the projects. So I have sent a request to the external examiner, so as to whether we could meet by Skype this afternoon and after this class and finish. He hasn't answered. So I will call him if he has an answer to make sure that we finish either today or tomorrow. My impression after reading all the projects is that everybody is safe on the pass area. So you shouldn't be nervous. Still, there is variation in the quality of the responses. So there will be some spread in the grading, I expect. Okay, so to today, the program for today is here on the frontier, and I wrote, we start the class by reviewing the solutions that I posted for the exercises the last time. Some of the exercises we did here, so I will do that briefly. They are posted, so you can upload the solutions from Frontier. But here they are. So the first exercise was about the organization developing a set of controls that decay over time, and we wanted to have a solution for that. And I think I reviewed that already last time, but still I can go briefly through that. So in this exercise, we assume that we have some controls that can be measured to reduce risk. What happens, the organization doesn't maintain the controls, so they are decaying over time. And the exercise suggests two important variables. The one is the controls, which we will measure by some number that expressing the quality of the controls, how effective they are to reduce the risk, and the process of decaying or obsolescence, as it's also called. And the proposal for this is assuming that the controls are a level that decays according to a rate control obsolescence. And how fast the controls decays depends on the one hand on the state of the controls, and on the other hand on some typical time of decay or obsolescence. And since there are not everything is specified in the problem, then we have to come up with some idea as to what is a reasonable time horizon. And this can, of course, be discussed, and it will depend, of course, also on the situation. It will depend how fast the controls decay, depend on other things, on advances in technology, attacks, technology, and so on. So any assumption that you can make can be perhaps defended by, it will be typically be several months or a few years. For the purpose of modeling, this is not so important. And the first part of the exercise is just coming upon that. Any questions? Okay, then the second exercise is about software vulnerabilities. they are tied to bugs that exist in the software, and if they are discovered, and they are typically discovered by testing the programming, when it crashes, then there is some bug. And then by several methods, the hackers can then identify what is happening and then seize the control of the software for the purposes. So once they discover that, the software is exposed to attacks, and they need to be removed. The way they are typically removed is that the software developer makes a patch available to the users that they can then, it's typically an executable file, then it fixes the bug. Okay, so again, it is not very different in thinking from the first exercise, where we had controls that were decaying, which was actually a bad thing, because you want the controls not to decay, not to become obsolete. In this case, you have a number of vulnerabilities that exist in the software, and they are bad, so you need to remove them, and they are removed by patching. But otherwise, the process is similar. In a sense, you have a level of vulnerabilities. They are being emptied by vulnerability removal. And as you can imagine, the more vulnerabilities there you have, the more that are detected, other things being equal. So that means the more that can be removed. So that's why you have a link which will, although it's not shown, it will have positive polarity. A link from vulnerabilities to vulnerabilities removal, this one. And then you have a typical time span that describes how fast this process is, the vulnerability removal time. From studies that have been done in practice, it turns out that since many people are still using old software, I have a friend, for instance, that never buys new versions of Windows, so he's still using his laptop with Windows that is 15 years old or whatever. So he's still in the process of being vulnerable to vulnerabilities that we have developed or entered Windows so many years ago. So this time horizon for average horizon for vulnerability removal of 8 to 10 years is not unrealistic if you consider that in the whole world there will be people still using old software. By the way, do you know how old the software is that is being used in the Norwegian offshore in the platforms? Well, it is a mix of software. But some systems, they were developed something like 30 years ago with Fortran, and they still are using them. They are kind of sacred cows. Very few people today can develop Fortran programs. So they are living with them despite the deficiencies and whatever, because it is too costly to repair them, and everything is intertwined, intertangled, and so on. So there exist in banks also old COBOL programs developed one generation ago. So it's very funny. Okay. Then an extension of the exercise one, the control obsolescence. So here it is assumed that the organization has an intention to detect whether the controls are adequate, and then live up to that, improve the controls. So in this case, what you get is a situation where the controls not only decay, but they are implemented. So to the left, you have a rate of implementing new controls. To the right, the controls that are decaying or obsolescing. And how would that work? Well, the controls influence how many security incidents that occur, how many attacks that are successful. And basically going from security incidents to control implementation, because there will be typically measures taking if too many incidents occur or if they are too costly, that will be a motivation to improve the controls. And typically the way organizations work is that they will compare with some desired level. How this is computed, that's a different thing. But in principle, you have a gap between the level of controls that one desires to have or thinks that they are necessary and the actual level of controls. So, as you can see, the control gap depends on the desired level of controls and the existing controls. And this gap will lead to decisions to implement controls. Again, all these processes, they need some time. So a simple way of modeling such processes is to assuming that there is some average or typical time for that. So here we have the time to implement the controls, which is some typical time, some average time, and here we have the average time for the controls to decay, the obsolescence time. Any questions? Okay, then we can continue with a meeting life cycle that's similar to the other, but here we don't provide so much information. So basically the process assumes that vulnerabilities are generated, they are dormant in the sense that they are not yet used, they are not known, they are not activated, but when they become known and the hackers develop attack weapons, then in a sense they are active. And that's when they become known, when people notice, oh yeah, here is a vulnerability that's being exploited, that's when people will tend to patch. We will see a little bit later today an advanced version of this idea, where we actually will simulate what happens, and that will actually will be based on some empirical studies. Okay, any questions? And then I think I skipped this one. You can have a look at number 5. Go to number 6, which goes back to the exercise 1, where we would like to simulate that. So we assume that the variable defining the quality of the controls assumes values between 0 and 1. 0 means the controls don't work, and 1, or unity, the controls give the maximum protection. If you have an organization with the controls in the level 1, then no attack will succeed. Of course, that never happens, but we can be quite close to this idea. And let's assume that at time 0, when we start the simulation, the value of the control is unity, full protection, or nearly full protection. Let's assume that the decay of the controls happens with the average time of 12 months. And then we get a diagram like this. I think this is quite easy to simulate. I don't know if I am going to spend time in creating that. I assume I have the model here easily. So let me fetch the model, which by the way is in Fronta. You can download the model. So let's find it. Controls, control obsolescence, I hope that is this one. Yes, it is this one. So maybe I can make it a bit bigger. Okay. So, as I said, this is the level of controls. And this is the rate control obsolescence. And as equation for controls, the initial value is 1. Can you see that, or is it too small here? Is it okay to see? Yeah, okay. So we put the initial value 1, and then you see that the rate control obsolescence, this one, appears here with a minus sign. Here I want to make a little remark. One of the students contacted me. He had followed the steps in the virus epidemic model, and he had a very strange behavior. Actually, I can show the model and show you how it can be debriefed. What I think it was very strange, because if you draw such diagram like this, where you have a level and then you have a flow which is an outflow, it's going out, then this minus sign here must appear by default because Venz inputs in there. By some reason which I haven't understood, this poor student had a plus sign here, and the whole thing was catastrophic, as I will show you in a moment. And I will show you also how one goes as to detecting this mistake. I really have no explanation why this minus sign that comes by default, if you draw the diagram correctly, turn up into a plus sign. Perhaps it's a bug in Venzim, or perhaps the student had been editing and by some reason putting a plus. One possibility for this to happen is if this is selected and then you click on this, you see the variable here, then you got a plus, and that gives you a completely different behavior. In such a cases, you can edit this equation. Even if it's put by Venzim in there, you can change things. And sometimes there are reasons why you need to change even this equation, but this is advanced modeling. Anyhow, that is the correct equation. And now we continue. As to the control obsolescence, which depends on these two, we have a situation which is very common. We can assume that this quantity will increase if the number of controls or the quality of control increases. The higher the quality, the more that can decay. And it will be in the inverse proportional to obsolescence time. The longer it takes to decay, the slower this rate is. So the equation here is, as you can see, controls divided by obsolescence time. And I think you can see that there, yes. And then, as I said, the obsolescence time we put here to some years. Here I put, in terms of months, 12 months. And then when you simulate, you get this situation where the quality of the control decays, first very quickly, then slower, making justice to the fact that the speed of decay depends on how high the value of the controls is. And then you can experiment. Here we synthesim. First, let me see in the control panel what I have. Control panel, data sets. Yes, I have two runs, the current run and the base run. The base, I need always two runs to compare. And then if I run synthesim, then I have a possibility to change the value of the obsolescence time. If I make it shorter, instead of 12, I put 9, then I get a red line for the base run, yes, which has the original value of 12. Whereas the blue line corresponds now to a faster decay. Shorter time means faster decay, and you see that in the blue line that it falls down quicker and then flattens up. Any questions to that? Okay. Then that much for the introduction, and as I said here, the solutions should be available. Are they? Didn't I upload them? Okay, maybe I haven't uploaded them. I will check. I will check if this slide is available in the next break. Okay. Then I would like to go to the review the solutions of the first examination project. So even if we don't have the grades yet, because I cannot release them until the external examiner and I have go through that and agreed on that, then I will discuss now, show you my proposed solution so that you can compare with what you did. So there you will find this document, which you can download. And here I give you some indications. First, as to concerning the project plan and the self-assessment, I will not give you a grade for that, because they are meant to be tools for you. So the advantage of you developing a good project plan and using self-assessment or self-evaluation is that you do better, increase your insight and your learning. So I recommend you to develop a good project plan, and I recommend you to conduct a self-assessment. On the other hand, when it comes to project plans and assessments and so on, there is quite much room for developing your own style. You have to find out which is the best method for your purposes. What I do recommend is that your project plan has a timeline. I've seen several project reports where the student just takes some things that needs to be done and that's it. Excuse me. Here the idea is to put some issues and depicting along a timeline. In my case, I will do that much faster, but I assume that the student who has prepared himself or herself well will be able to do that in 8 hours. The advantage of having a timeline is that you can compare with your performance, and then you can learn which are the issues that need improvement. So for instance, if you find out that in order to understand well the project and really hit on all the things that need to be done, if you find out that you need more time to read, then that's important that you record that for the future, so that you have a realistic project plan. Also, you can then figure out where you can learn more. So for instance, maybe you need more practice in how to scan a text so as to identify the information that is crucial for your task, and also structure that, because the information, as you are digesting the information in the project description, you have to make sense of that. So you identify things that are important and make perhaps notes. I use this for this purpose, for that purpose, like conceptualizing the model, testing the model, whatever. Then, typically in projects, you will have concurrent tasks. So for instance, I recommend you that you are using the quality, the self-evaluation form to quality assure your project as you are working, not just in the end. So you have a list of things to verify that you are doing it correctly. That's what you are assessing. And you should do that through the whole project so as to have control of what you are doing. If you went until the end, then maybe you have done things that are wrong and you don't have any more time. You have to submit a project report with mistakes. So have a look at that and develop your way of having a project plan. Too much detail is counterproductive because then you get lost in details. Too little detail is also not good because then you miss things. So the art is in aggregating tasks to some level. So for instance, in the question of the European case, I put just archetype for European case and then description of the archetype. So modeling, describing. Similarly for the US case. So that's quite aggregate. You could go farther down and for instance break this down and devise the intended consequence loop, devise the unintended consequence loop, identify the archetype, and so on and so on. And that could be perhaps defensible to have a bit more of detail. But as I said, if you have too much detail in the project plan, then you have you lose the overview. Whereas in the assessment, you might need more detail because you have to check a number of things. So in my last page here, I put some way of assessing this, which I created with an Excel arc. This is of course too little. The font is too small to be read here and now, but you can inspect that. Oops, I see page 6 of 5. That doesn't make much sense. I guess Word didn't update. I guess it's 6 pages. Yes, it's 6 pages, but Word didn't update the information. Okay, I will fix that. Now as to the self-evaluation. This is a new concept for most students, and the idea is that you reflect more on what you are doing and how well you are doing. So in order to have a good self-evaluation, it's important to think, okay, how can I ensure that I am doing the things that I should do and that I are doing them correctly. What I see in many cases is that students assess what they did based on some intuition, what they in Norwegian call magefølelse. That's better than nothing, but I would recommend you that you think deeper, because understanding a good evaluation relies on understanding better what you need to do. So it's in a sense, it is a loop. You have to understand better so that you can assess yourself, and if you assess yourself, you understand better. And you should engage in this loop. I do not expect you to do a first-class self-assessment just like that. But you should be able to do that by engaging in that and learning. Okay, then I jump now to a PowerPoint presentation, which gives me a bit more bigger diagrams. it is basically from the same thing that you see in the PDF document, but yeah, it's a bit bigger. So I'll structure the solutions. This is basically something that I have given you before when we had the exercises on system archetypes. So you should know this slide or something similar. What I want to emphasize is that sometimes you can define different archetypes. Sometimes you can give good arguments for different archetypes, and depending on how well you reason, I may buy that. Ultimately, the quality of the archetype should be tied to a simulation model, and if there is some doubt as to which is the best archetype, then the best simulation will correspond to the best archetype. This said, one issue in this case was as to whether the intended consequence loop was reinforcing or balancing. So let's look a little bit at this. Let's look at the case, the burden of proof on the customer, which is the European case. About half of the class, or perhaps even a little bit more than the class, hit on the right archetype. The others, they made some mistakes. That doesn't mean that they don't pass. It means simply that I have to deduct some points. Again, it depends also on how well you have argued for your case. But I think that in this case, it should be easy, if you follow these steps, to choose the correct archetype. The key to do that is to be very, very clear as to what is the action, what is the outcome, which is the intended effect of the action, and what is the system reaction, which is the unintended effect of the action. Okay? You have to read it very carefully, but you have to find, okay, in this project description, where is the action? Which is the action? Which is the outcome? Which is the system reaction? Now, if you read the European case, the action is what the actor does in order to achieve something. And it is said in a project description that the bank enforces the burden of proof on customers. So that's the action. This and nothing else. And this was overlooked by several students, which therefore started the problem with on the wrong foot. So the burden of proof, that is the measures that the bank will apply. They will change over time because the bank will, depending on the situation, tighten the screws or release them or whatever as necessary to achieve the goals. And what is the goal? The intended outcome is to control the fraud. That is to prevent fraud, ideally, completely, but that's never possible. So as much as possible. Typically, in such situations, the bank or the chief security officer of the bank will define some target which is economically feasible. It is too costly to prevent all fraud, so they will reach some situation where they accept some fraud, some residual risk. What was the unintended system reaction? It is the fraud epidemic, and that occurs, as it was described, because the security of the ATMs was not prioritized. What happens then is that the crooks exploit that it is easy to get the money illegally, while the bank will chase in the wrong people, because they will look for the customers, chase them and annoying them, in fact losing customers as well, because their strategy is to put the burden of the proof on the customer. Something happens, you were the one that stole the money, and it will in many cases be somebody else which is exploiting the vulnerabilities. So then you have to ask the question for the intended consequence loop. Does the action intend to control some outcome, that is, achieve some target, or does the action intend to fuel some growth or decay? And depending on the answer, you will need a balancing or reinforcing loop. Okay? And here, if you read that carefully, I believe that you will land on the conclusion the action, which is the burden of proof from the customers, intends to control the fraud. And then you get the problem archetype to the left and the solution archetype to the right. So, action, burden of proof from customers, intend to reduce the number of fraudulent transactions. On the other hand, for the bank, how much they apply these measures depends on how many fraudulent transactions that occur. If there are many, they will ensure that these measures are very tight. If they become less and less, then they may be reducing that. Now, the unintended consequence is because the banks will blame the customer if something happens, they will feel complacent. Complacent in English means they don't bother so much. It's not the problem, it's the problem of the customers. If it's the problem of the customers, then the bank will not be very willing to spend on security. So the security of the ATMs will stay at low level and will also decay. This takes some time, so that's why you have a delay here. Now, the ATM security will determine how many transactions that are fraud. And again, there is some time delay because it takes some time for the crooks to find out how best to beat the ATMs, the security of the ATMs. Now, if you look at this loop that arises as unintended loop, so you can see that this is a reinforcing loop. The more burden, the more the burden of the proof is on the customers, the more the banks is complacent, the less the security is, the more fraudulent transactions, and because the customers are blamed, the more the bank will put the burden on the customers. So you have a reinforcing loop, which is the ATM fraud epidemic, which is actually fueling the number of fraudulent transactions and at the same time annoying the customers, which the bank depends on. So that's not a very good strategy. In the end, because of the fact that so many transactions are fraudulent and the customers, they either protest or they are leaving the bank and so, the bank will have to fix this. And since we have an out-of-control troll archetype, we know that the way to fix this is to couple the system reaction, the fraudulent transactions, to the outcome, the fraudulent transactions, to the unintended consequence. So one way to do that is the bank now trying to fix the vulnerabilities to improve the security, which again takes time. And you get then a balancing loop. By the way, it's balancing, not balanced. Some students write balanced loop and reinforced loop, but it is balancing. It is balancing is what it's doing, and it is reinforcing, that's what it's doing. And I call that loop, the bank awaits at last, because indeed that happens not proactively but reactively. Any questions? Okay, burden of proof on the bank, again the same thing, the key, that applies for all archetypes, for all problems. When you want to design an archetype, you have to be successful in identifying the action, the outcome, and the system reaction. In this case, if you read the project carefully, the action is the implementation of the bank strategy, which in the American case is the measures that implement the burden of proof on the bank. And these measures, again, will be dynamic. They will change along the timeline, depending on what happens. The intended outcome, as in the European case, is to control fraud, only that the means are different. The unintended system reaction is that there are crooks around, which some of the students thought they were meant their customers. Some of the customers may act as crooks, but the fact that the bank, that the crooks know that the bank will look in the first place for their own security, and rather than chasing or suing the bank customers, means that they see an opportunity of committing fraud without a high risk, because the bank will normally not spend a lot of money unless there are huge amounts of money that's stolen, and normally that doesn't happen with the ATM at once. It will happen cumulatively. If the bank is seeing that there are more and more fraud and that is increasing and so on, then finally they will understand that the security that they have is not good enough. Because the security is never a static thing. Even if the bank invested proactively in security and they have secure ATMs, the crooks will invent new methods of defeating the secure ATMs. So that's why sooner or later, that's why the bank will discover sooner or later that they need to improve the security, even if they have done that proactively. Of course, clever banks, they will be prepared for that and be on the guard all the time. So again, you ask the question, does the action intend to control some outcome? Yes, it does. It intends to control fraud. So then immediately you have to think of a balancing feedback loop, because the balancing feedback loop is the one that intends to control something. So you have again an out of control archetype. It is less out of control than in the European case, because the bank has done security spending proactively. They have, before installing the ATMs, make sure that they are as secure as possible. Of course, there is always some residual risk. It will cost infinite much to make completely secure ATMs. So the bank has decided, I spend so much on security, and they, since they have the burden of proof, they will ensure that this, they are quite secure. But then there will be crooks betting on the bank accepting the loss. That's the unintended consequence. There will be new fraud schemes which will increase fraudulent transactions, and you have also a reinforcing loop that to some extent threatens the control. So it is out of control, not to the same extent as the European case, but ultimately, at least if the bank doesn't maintain the quality of the ATMs, then that will sooner or later also be out of control. So what has the bank to do? Monitor the number of fraudulent transactions, improve the security, and that means innovating, because the crooks will invent new schemes. You have also to invent new defenses. All this takes time, and then you have a balancing feedback loop, which I call improving to beat the crooks. You have an arms race where the crooks are doing that and so on. And with the first 45 minutes went in this way, so we take a break of 15 minutes now.